never gone back to bed again, except for my regular 8 hours of sleep each night. I realize now that if the Japanese had not struck at Pearl Harbor, I would probably have remained a semi-invalid all my life. I was comfortable in bed, I was constantly waited on, and I now realize that I was unconsciously losing my will to rehabilitate myself. The attack on Pearl Harbor was one of the greatest tragedies in American history, but as far as I was concerned, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. That terrible crisis gave me strength that I never dreamed I possessed. It took my attention off myself and focused it on others. It gave me something big and vital and important to live for. I no longer had time to think about myself or care about myself. A third of the people who rushed a psychiatrist for help could probably cure themselves if they could only do as Margaret Yates did, get interested in helping others. My idea? No, that's approximately what Carl Jung said. And he ought to know if anybody does. He said, about one-third of my patients are suffering from no clinically definable neurosis, but from the senselessness and emptiness of their lives. And to put it another way, they're trying to thumb a ride through life, and the parade passes them by. So they rush to a psychiatrist with their petty, senseless, useless lives. Having missed the boat, they stand on the wharf, blaming everyone except themselves, and demanding that the world cater to their self-centered desires. You may be saying to yourself now, well, I'm not impressed by these stories. I myself could get interested in a couple of orphans I met on Christmas Eve, and if I'd been at Pearl Harbor, I would gladly have done what Margaret Taylor Yates did. But with me, things are different. I live an ordinary, humdrum life. I work at a dull job 8 hours a day. Nothing dramatic ever happens to me. How can I get interested in helping others? And why should I? What is there in it for me? A fair question. I'll try to answer it. However humdrum your existence may be, you surely meet some people every day of your life. And what do you do about them? Do you merely stare through them, or do you try to find out what it is that makes them tick? How about the postman, for example? He travels hundreds of miles every year delivering your mail, but have you ever taken the trouble to find out where he lives, or asked to see a snapshot of his wife and his kids? Did you ever ask him if he gets tired, or if he ever gets bored? What about the grocery boy, the newspaper vendor, the chap at the corner who polishes your shoes? These people are human, bursting with troubles and dreams and private ambitions. They're also bursting for the chance to share them with someone. But do you ever let them? Do you ever show an eager, honest interest in them or their lives? That's the sort of thing I mean. You don't have to become a Florence Nightingale or a social reformer to help improve the world, your own private world. You can start tomorrow morning with the people you meet. What's in it for you? Much greater happiness, greater satisfaction, and pride in yourself. Aristotle called this kind of attitude enlightened selfishness. Zoroaster said, doing good for others is not a duty, it is a joy, for it increases your own health and happiness. And Benjamin Franklin summed it up very simply. When you're good to others, said Franklin, you are best to yourself. No discovery of modern psychology, wrote Henry C. Link, director of the Psychological Service Center in New York, is, in my opinion, so important as its scientific proof of the necessity of self-sacrifice or discipline to self-realization and happiness. Thinking of others will not only keep you from worrying about yourself, it will also help you make a lot of friends and have a lot of fun. How? Well, I once asked Professor William Lyon Phelps of Yale how he did it, and here's what he said. I never go into a hotel or a barber shop or a store without saying something agreeable to everyone I meet. I try to say something that treats them as an individual, not merely a cog in a machine. I sometimes compliment the girl who waits on me in the store by telling her how beautiful her eyes are or her hair. I'll ask a barber if he doesn't get tired standing on his feet all day. I'll ask him how he came to take up barbering, how long he's been at it, how many heads of hair he's cut. I'll help him figure it out. I find that taking an interest in people makes them beam with pleasure. I frequently shake hands with a redcap who's carried my grip. It gives him a new lift and freshens him up for the whole day. One extremely hot summer day, I went to a dining car of New Haven Railway to have lunch. The crowded car was almost like a furnace, and the service was slow. When the steward finally got around to handing me the menu, I said, "The boys back there cooking in that hot kitchen certainly must be suffering today." The steward began to curse. His tones were bitter. At first I thought he was angry. "Good God Almighty," he exclaimed. "People come in here and complain about the food. They kick about the slow service and growl about the heat and the prices. I've listened to their criticism for 19 years, and you're the first person, the only person who's ever expressed any sympathy for the cooks back there in that boiling kitchen. I wish to God we had more passengers like you." The steward was astounded because I had thought of the cooks as human beings, and not merely as a cog in the organization of a great railway. "What people want," continued Professor Phelps, "is a little attention as human beings. When I meet a man on the street with a beautiful dog, I always comment on the dog's beauty. As I walk on and glance back over my shoulder, I frequently see the man petting and admiring the dog. My appreciation has renewed his appreciation. One time in England, I met a shepherd and expressed my sincere admiration for his big, intelligent sheepdog. I asked him to tell me how he trained the dog. As I walked away, I glanced back over my shoulder and saw the dog standing with his paws on the shepherd's shoulders, and the shepherd was petting him. By taking a little interest in the shepherd and his dog, I made the shepherd happy. I made the dog happy, and I made myself happy. Can you imagine a man who goes around shaking hands with porters and expressing sympathy for the cooks in the hot kitchen and telling people how much he admires their dogs? Can you imagine a man like that being sour and worried and needing the services of a psychiatrist? You can't, can you? No, of course not. A Chinese proverb puts it this way: "A bit of fragrance always clings to the hand that gives you roses." You didn't have to tell that to Billy Phelps of Yale. He knew it. He lived it. If you're a man, skip this paragraph. It won't interest you. It tells how a worried, unhappy girl got several men to propose to her. The girl who did that is a grandmother now. A few years ago, I spent the night in her and her husband's home. I'd been giving a lecture in her town, and the next morning she drove me about 50 miles to catch a train on the main line of the New York Central. We got to talking about winning friends, and she said, "Mr. Carnegie, I'm going to tell you something that I've never confessed to anyone before, not even to my husband." She told me that she'd been reared in a social register family in Philadelphia. "The tragedy of my girlhood and young womanhood," she said, "was our poverty. We could never entertain in the way the other girls in my social set entertained. My clothes were never of the best quality. I outgrew them, and they didn't fit, and they were often out of style. I was so humiliated, so ashamed, that I often cried myself to sleep. Finally, in sheer desperation, I hit upon the idea of always asking my partner at dinner parties to tell me about his experiences, his ideas, his plans for the future. I didn't ask these questions because I was especially interested in the answers. I did it solely to keep my partner from looking at my poor clothes. But a strange thing happened. As I listened to these young men talk and learned more about them, I really became interested in listening to what they had to say. I became so interested that I myself sometimes forgot about my clothes. But the astounding thing to me was this. Since I was a good listener and encouraged those boys to talk about themselves, I gave them happiness, and I gradually became the most popular girl in our social group, and 3 of these men proposed marriage to me." Now, some people who read this chapter are going to say, "All this talk about getting interested in others is a lot of damn nonsense, sheer religious pap, none of that stuff for me. I'm going to put money in my purse, I'm going to grab all I can get and grab it now, and to hell with the other dumb clucks. Well, if that's your opinion, you're entitled to it. But if you're right, then all the great philosophers and teachers since the beginning of recorded history, Jesus, Confucius, Buddha, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, St. Francis, were all wrong. But since you may sneer at the teachings of religious leaders, let's turn for advice to a couple of atheists. First, let's take the late A.E. Hausman, professor at Cambridge University and one of the most distinguished scholars of his generation. In 1936, he gave an address at Cambridge University on the name and nature of poetry. In that address, he declared that the greatest truth ever uttered and the most profound moral discovery of all times were these words of Jesus. "He that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it." We have heard preachers say that all our lives, but Hausman was an atheist, a pessimist, a man who contemplated suicide, and yet he felt that the man who thought only of himself wouldn't get much out of life. He would be miserable. But the man who forgot himself in service to others would find the joy of living. If you're not impressed by what A.E. Hausman said, let's turn for advice to the most distinguished American atheist of the 20th century, Theodore Dreiser. Dreiser ridiculed all religions as fairy tales and regarded life as a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Yet Dreiser advocated the one great principle that Jesus taught, service to others. "If he, man, is expected to extract any joy out of his span," Dreiser said, "he must think and plan to make things better not only for himself but for others, since joy for himself depends upon his joy in others and theirs in him." If we're going to make things better for others, as Dreiser advocated, let's be quick about it. Time's a-wasting. "I shall pass this way but once. Therefore, any good that I can do or any kindness that I can show, let me do it now. Let me not defer nor neglect it, for I shall not pass this way again." So, if you want to banish worry and cultivate peace and happiness, here's Rule 7. Forget yourself by becoming interested in others. Every day, do a good deed that will put a smile of joy on someone's face. Part 4 in a nutshell. 7 ways to cultivate a mental attitude that will bring you peace and happiness. Rule 1. Let's fill our minds with thoughts of peace, courage, health, and hope, for our life is what our thoughts make it. Rule 2. Let's never try to get even with our enemies, because if we do, we will hurt ourselves far more than we hurt them. Let's do as General Eisenhower does. Let's never waste a minute thinking about people we don't like. Rule 3. A. Instead of worrying about ingratitude, let's expect it. Let's remember that Jesus healed 10 lepers in one day, and only one thanked him. Why should we expect more gratitude than Jesus got? B. Let's remember that the only way to find happiness is not to expect gratitude, but to give for the joy of giving. C. Let's remember that gratitude is a cultivated trait, so that if we want our children to be grateful, we must train them to be grateful. Rule 4. Count your blessings, not your troubles. Rule 5. Let's not imitate others. Let's find ourselves and be ourselves. For envy is ignorance, and imitation is suicide. Rule 6. When fate hands us a lemon, let's try to make a lemonade. Rule 7. Let's forget our own unhappiness by trying to create a little happiness for others. When you're good to others, you are best to yourself. Part 5. The Perfect Way to Conquer Worry. Chapter 19. How My Mother and Father Conquered Worry. As I have said, I was born and brought up on a Missouri farm. Like most farmers of that day, my parents had pretty hard scratching. My mother had been a country school teacher. My father had been a farmhand working for $12 a month. Mother made not only my clothes, but also the soap with which we washed our clothes. We rarely had any cash, except once a year when we sold our hogs. We traded our butter and eggs at the grocery store for flour, sugar, coffee. When I was 12 years old, I didn't have as much as 50 cents a year to spend on myself. I can still remember the day we went to a 4th of July celebration, and Father gave me 10 cents to spend as I wished. I felt the wealth of the Indies was mine. I walked a mile to attend a one-room country school. I walked when the snow was deep and the thermometer shivered around 28 degrees below zero. Until I was 14, I never had any rubbers or overshoes. During the long, cold winters, my feet were always wet and cold. As a child, I never dreamed that anyone had dry, warm feet during the winter. My parents slaved 16 hours a day, yet we constantly were oppressed by debts and harassed by hard luck. One of my earliest memories is watching the floodwaters of the One O True River rolling over our corn and hayfields, destroying everything. The floods destroyed our crops 6 years out of seven, year after year. Our hogs died of cholera, and we burned them. I can close my eyes now and recall the pungent odor of burning hog flesh. 1 year, the floods didn't come. We raised a bumper corn crop, bought feed cattle, fattened them with our own corn. But the floods might just as well have drowned our corn that year, for the price of fat cattle fell on the Chicago market, and after feeding and fattening the cattle, we got only $30 more for them than we'd paid for them. $30 for a whole year's work. No matter what we did, we lost money. I can still remember the mule colts that my father bought. We fed them for 3 years, hired men to break them, then shipped them to Memphis, Tennessee, and sold them for less than what we'd paid for them 3 years previously. After 10 years of hard, grueling work, we were not only penniless, we were heavily in debt. Our farm was mortgaged. Try as hard as we might, we couldn't even pay the interest on the mortgage. The bank that held the mortgage abused and insulted my father and threatened to take his farm away from him. Father was 47 years old. After more than 30 years of hard work, he had nothing but debts and humiliation. It was more than he could take. He worried. His health broke. He had no desire for food. In spite of the hard physical work he was doing in the field all day, he had to take medicine to give him an appetite. He lost flesh. The doctor told my mother that he'd be dead within 6 months. Father was so worried that he no longer wanted to live. I've often heard my mother say that when Father went to the barn to feed the horses and milk the cows and didn't come back as soon as she expected, she'd go out to the barn, fearing that she would find his body dangling from the end of a rope. One day, as he returned home from Maryville, where the banker had threatened to foreclose the mortgage, he stopped his horses on a bridge crossing the 102 River, got off the wagon, and stood there for a long time, looking down at the water, debating with himself whether he should jump in and end it all. Years later, Father told me that the only reason he didn't jump was because of my mother's deep, abiding, and joyous belief that if we loved God and kept His commandments, everything would come out all right. The mother was right. Everything did come out all right in the end. Father lived 42 happy years longer and died in 1941 at the age of 89. During all those years of struggle and heartache, my mother never worried. She took all her troubles to God in prayer. Every night before we went to bed, Mother would read a chapter from the Bible. Frequently, Mother or Father would read these comforting words of Jesus, "In my Father's house are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you, that where I am, there ye may be also." Then we all knelt down before our chairs in that lonely Missouri farmhouse and prayed for God's love and protection. When William James was professor of philosophy at Harvard, he said, "Of course, the sovereign cure for worry is religious faith." You don't have to go to Harvard to discover that. My mother found that out on a Missouri farm. Neither floods, nor debts, nor disaster could suppress her happy, radiant, and victorious spirit. I can still hear her singing as she worked, "Peace, peace, wonderful peace, flowing down from the Father above. Sweep over my spirit forever, I pray, in fathomless billows of love." My mother wanted me to devote my life to religious work. I thought seriously of becoming a foreign missionary. Then I went away to college, and gradually as the years passed, a change came over me. I studied biology, science, philosophy, and comparative religions. I read books on how the Bible was written. I began to question many of its assertions. I began to doubt many of the narrow doctrines taught by the country preachers of that day. I was bewildered. Like Walt Whitman, I felt the curious, abrupt questioning stir within me. I didn't know what to believe. I saw no purpose in life. I stopped praying. I became an agnostic. I believed that all life was planless and aimless. I believed that human beings had no more divine purpose than had the dinosaurs that roamed the earth 200 million years ago. I felt that someday the human race would perish, just as the dinosaurs had. I knew that science taught that the sun was slowly cooling and that when its temperature fell even 10%, no form of life could exist on earth. I sneered at the idea of a beneficent God who had created man in his own likeness. I believed that the billions upon billions of suns whirling through black, cold, lifeless space had been created by blind force. Maybe they'd never been created at all. Maybe they had existed forever, just as time and space have always existed. Do I profess to know the answers to all those questions now? No. No man has ever been able to explain the mystery of the universe, the mystery of life. We're surrounded by mysteries. The operation of your body is a profound mystery. So is the electricity in your home. So is the flower in the crannied wall. So is the green grass outside your window. Charles F. Kettering, the guiding genius of General Motors Research Laboratories, gave Antioch College $30,000 a year out of his own pocket to try to discover why grass is green. He declared that if we knew how grass is able to transfer sunlight, water, and carbon dioxide into food sugar, we could transform civilization. Even the operation of the engine in your car is a profound mystery. General Motors Research Laboratories have spent years of time and millions of dollars trying to find out how and why a spark in the cylinder sets off an explosion that makes your car run. The fact that we don't understand totally the mysteries of our bodies or electricity or a gas engine doesn't keep us from using and enjoying them. The fact that I don't understand the mysteries of prayer and religion no longer keeps me from enjoying the richer, happier life that religion brings. At long last, I realize the wisdom of Santayana's words, "Man is not made to understand life, but to live it." I have gone back, well, I was about to say I had gone back to religion, but that would not be accurate. I have gone forward to a new concept of religion. I no longer have the faintest interest in the differences in creeds that divide the churches, but I'm tremendously interested in what religion does for me, just as I'm interested in what electricity and good food and water do for me. They help me to lead a richer, fuller, happier life. But religion does far more than that. It brings me spiritual values. It gives me, as William James put it, a new zest for life, more life, a larger, richer, more satisfying life. It gives me faith, hope, and courage. It banishes tensions, anxieties, fears, and worries. It gives purpose to my life and direction. It vastly improves my happiness. It gives me abounding health. It helps me to create for myself an oasis of peace amidst the whirling sands of life. Francis Bacon was right when he said over 300 years ago, "A little philosophy inclineth man's mind to atheism, but depth in philosophy bringeth men's minds about to religion." I can remember the days when people talked about the conflict between science and religion, but no more. The newest of all sciences, psychiatry, is teaching what Jesus taught. Why? Because psychiatrists realize that prayer and a strong religious faith will banish the worries, the anxieties, the strains and fears that cause more than half of all our ills. They know, as one of their leaders, Dr. A.A. Brill, said, "Anyone who is truly religious does not develop a neurosis." If religion isn't true, then life is meaningless. It is a tragic farce. I interviewed Henry Ford, a few years prior to his death. Before I met him, I had expected him to show the strains of the long years he'd spent in building up and managing one of the world's greatest businesses. So I was surprised to see how calm and well and peaceful he looked at 78. When I asked him if he ever worried, he replied, "No. I believe God is managing affairs, and that he doesn't need any advice from me. With God in charge, I believe that everything will work out for the best in the end. So what is there to worry about?" Today, even many psychiatrists are becoming modern evangelists. They're not urging us to lead religious lives to avoid hellfires in the next world, but they are urging us to lead religious lives to avoid the hellfires of stomach ulcer, angina pectoris, nervous breakdowns, and insanity. As an example of what our psychologists and psychiatrists are teaching, read The Return to Religion by Dr. Henry C. Link. Yes, the Christian religion is an inspiring, health-giving activity. Jesus said, "I came that ye might have life and have it more abundantly." Jesus denounced and attacked the dry forms and dead rituals that passed for religion in his day. He was a rebel. He preached a new kind of religion, a religion that threatened to upset the world. This is why he was crucified. He preached that religion should exist for man, not man for religion, that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. He talked more about fear than he did about sin. The wrong kind of fear is a sin against your health, a sin against the richer, fuller, happier, courageous life that Jesus advocated. Emerson spoke of himself as a professor of the science of joy. Jesus, too, was a teacher of the science of joy. He commanded his disciples to rejoice and leap for joy. Jesus declared that there were only two important things about religion: loving God with all our heart, and our neighbor as ourselves. Any man who does that is religious, regardless of whether he knows it. My father-in-law, Henry Price of Tulsa, Oklahoma, is a good example. He tries to live by the golden rule, and he is incapable of doing anything mean, selfish, or dishonest. However, he doesn't attend church and regards himself as an agnostic. Nonsense. What makes a man a Christian? I'll let John Bailey answer that. He was a distinguished professor who taught theology at the University of Edinburgh. He said, "What makes a man a Christian is neither his intellectual acceptance of certain ideas, nor his conformity to a certain rule, but his possession of a certain spirit, and his participation in a certain life." If that makes a man a Christian, then Henry Price is a noble one. William James, the father of modern psychology, wrote to his friend Professor Thomas Davidson, saying that as the years went by, he found himself less and less able to get along without God. Earlier in this book, I mentioned that when the judges tried to pick the best story on worry sent in by my students, they had so much difficulty in choosing between two outstanding stories that the prize money was split. Here's the second story that tied for first prize, the unforgettable experience of a woman who had to find out the hard way that she couldn't get along without God. I'm calling this woman Mary Cushman, although that's not her actual name. She has children and grandchildren who might be embarrassed to see her story in print, so I agreed to disguise her identity. However, the woman herself is real, very real. Here's how her story goes. "During the Depression," she said, "my husband's average salary was $18 a week. Many times we didn't even have that because he didn't get paid when he was ill, and that was often. He had a series of minor accidents. He also had mumps, scarlet fever, and repeated attacks of flu. We lost the little house that we'd built with our own hands. We owed $50 at the grocery store and had five children to feed. I took in washing and ironing from the neighbors and bought second-hand clothes from the Salvation Army store and made them over for my children to wear. I made myself ill with worry. One day, the grocer to whom we owed $50 accused my 11-year-old boy of stealing a couple of pencils. My son wept as he told me about it. I knew he was honest and sensitive, and I knew that he'd been disgraced and humiliated in front of other people. That was the straw that broke my back. I thought of all the misery we had endured, and I couldn't see any hope for the future. I must have become temporarily insane with worry, for I shut off my washing machine, took my little 5-year-old daughter up to the bedroom, and plugged up the windows and cracks with paper and rags. My little girl said to me, "Mommy, what are you doing?" And I answered, "There's a little draft in here." Then I turned on the gas heater.